Welcome to the Round 6 Podcast, a weekly roundtable discussion featuring a variety of automotive subjects, interviews, special guests, and stories. Hosted by the Round 6 Gearheads, Brian Stupski, Brad King, Eric Hibbs, Alex Welsh, and Del Swanson. We welcome you back to part 2 of our very special masterclass with automotive artist Tom Fritz.
As a kid developing, when I would go to the races, I was kind of the goofball. I was the nerd. I was the dork, the spaz, you know. And the reason was, when I got out of the races and we were all driving home in the station wagon, and of course everybody is relating to everyone else what was the coolest thing about the night. Well, it was when Ron Hornaday passed Jimmy Insulo on the fourth corner, you know, names and numbers and times. And Tom, what did you think was cool? Well, I thought it was cool when the on the back stretch there at night, when the radiator hose busted up and suddenly the track was full of steam. And as the car was driving down, you know, the cockpit filled with steam and was flagging out the back of the car. That was cool. Or I loved the way that the overrun would come out the exhaust pipe when the car pulled into the third corner and the driver took his foot off the gas. You know, the blue flames and the burbling and the, you know, that is cool. And that was what I thought at the drag races. I thought the coolest job would be the photographer, but I wanted to be the guy that jumped over the wall and laid down on the track as the car went by. So I can look back, and I knew that I was very visual and emotionally oriented. The facts, figures, numbers, all that stuff, you know, that didn't jive with me. And so I put that in my paintings today. I still do. It's, you know, if you look at the viewpoint, the point of view of my paintings, where I'm placing, you know, you as a viewer in my work, that's where I want to be. The lighting was always critical to me. I love dramatic lighting, and the drama of lighting just adds to the drama of the subject. Now, when you look at the quiet moments, you know, the guy is standing around an old hot rod or an old bike. I am drawing on my personal experiences in the 70s. I mean, in high school, in the parking lot, you know, outside of the arcade or outside of McDonald's after the football game or whatever, you know, the human interactions that revolve around vehicles are universal and timeless. And so I put those in. I just transfer them into the paintings. I'm usually telling a story with my work. Yeah, so this is kind of how it all comes together for me. You mentioned we get into the 60s. I would like to do some more 60s cars, but suddenly we get into the show car stuff. And I can appreciate it, and I love it. However, another important factor for us artists is making a living doing what we're doing. And I hate to sound like so cut and dry here, but if you make a specific car, suddenly your painting becomes very volatile.
Right.
It doesn't have a broad appeal. Some people will like it. Maybe fewer than more will like it. Or someone won't like it because, oh, I saw this. And, you know, And I have to make a living doing this. I have to sell that painting.
Right.
And so I kind of target my market to, you know, the more broadly accepted imagery. I just don't want to wind up one day with a stack of paintings, you know, that I'm just going to pile up in the backyard and torch because I can't get rid of them.
Yeah.
So that's part of the reality of it. In the motorcycles, I love the choppers that were in the valley, in the San Fernando Valley in the late 60s, early 70s. I love that early stuff. And it was everywhere back then for me. We had the San Fernando drag strip out in Sylmar, over in San Fernando area. And I remember watching the dragsters being towed down to San Fernando, going down Devonshire Street, Chatsworth Street, where I lived, and watching them go by. And this was in the days when paint was weight and the cars were incredibly raw. And that is kind of my era for the drag racing, was when it was small and raw and everybody could get into it. I love that kind of appeal. Once the money got behind it and it became commercial, it kind of, you know, the imagery for me kind of dies. But that's personal for me, and I can paint it, but
no, I think that has broad appeal, actually.
Another thing that happened was when I first started painting, there was a lot of artists, and there still are today, they're painting the subject matter. And as artists, we all need our reference, especially when you're painting historical objects. You need to work from reference, and there's a lot of photographs out there. And when you work from old photographs, there are copyright issues. You have to research who owns that copyright, get a clearance or a license from them. Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult, and that throws cold water on a fire. If you're, you got you're all set to start painting something, you know, that'll certainly kill it for you. So I have to go out and do a lot of my own photography and dig up the cars. And a lot of times backwards engineer what I'm looking at, because things have changed, you know, wheel tire combinations, how you start an old Hemi engine, you know, in the days before the electric starters, and then you bump started, there's a different look to the front of the engine
right.
Mm-hmm. So I have to take all that into consideration when I'm doing my paintings. Like I was saying, the old choppers, I've gotten into that, and there's an incredible emotional impact to those kind of paintings. But once again, I have to consider my market. You know, I've had some people buy some originals from me, and they love them because of the emotion that I put in the painting. But they're a difficult sell because of the subject.
The bikes are?
Especially the choppers.
Really?
Yeah. And the old gang stuff, you know, you got to be really careful if you're painting cuts with the colors on them and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So it's, you know, and those are issues for at least this artist. But, you know.
So, Tom, are you doing more like just personal projects at this point, or are you doing much commission work, or how do you schedule your time?
I consider commissions. I turn them down because I don't like where the commission's going or the subject matter, or it's not fulfilling to me, or if I feel that I'm going to be a risk for someone. I don't handle those. I will redirect if someone's, you know, I'll pass the name along to another artist or suggest another artist if I feel that it would be better handled by them. And I have a couple right now that are on the clipboard, but I'm doing basically mostly what I want to do. I feel I'm strongest there. The results are better. You know, it's more fun. Mm-hmm. And another thing about commission work is it's kind of sometimes like swimming upstream because you have expectations that you're working towards. A commission is a collaboration between the artist and the commissioning body. And they have what they envision. And certainly you have what you would like to pull out of the painting. And so there has to be a happy medium there.
Right.
And sometimes that can get in the way, you know. But yeah, so I do consider commission work.
Interesting.
Speaking of commissions, you know, and your work, what is a typical time commitment on a painting? Just to, you know, I know it depends on the size and all that kind of stuff, but what's a typical a painting as far as your time commitment goes?
Well, at the bottom end, I guess it would be when I do the Barrett Jackson auction in Scottsdale. In January, I'll normally work on three paintings in the booth, and they are roughly in the 16 by 20 size. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, one year I finished all three there. Sometimes I'll get two completed. Sometimes you get pretty darn close, but they need, you know, a couple of sessions in the studio to really, mm-hmm. you know, finalize. But people get to see me working there. And so I'm there for 10 days and those three paintings get done in those 10 or get that close in 10 days.
Okay.
And that is in between talking to people and, you know, the day in, day out business. Yeah. If I'm down here in the studio, depending on the size, most of my paintings take me about a week and a half to 2 weeks. If they take any longer than that, they start to turn into cottage cheese. Yeah, so you know that's about how they go. I like to work direct. I work best start to finish on a painting. I normally don't have two or three, or one leaning up against the wall, face to the wall, so I don't have to look at it for a while. I usually work pretty direct, and that is kind of a. That is kind of a result of being a commercial artist with deadlines all the time.
Sure.
You know, just take completion and then moving on to the next one.
Okay.
That kind of pinpoints my problem with cars is, you know, when I'm building a car, if I work on more than one at a time, nothing gets done.
Yeah.
So if I just turn all my focus to one vehicle, which I really need to do to get something done, I'm a lot more effective.
It's funny. A lot of the, you know, the same, situation that builders have in their day in and day out, I can sit down and talk with them and you can almost, connect with them. What happens in the studio is happening in their garage too, you know?
Right.
Same kind of mentality, I guess. But, yeah. You know, it's all good.
Very cool. So, a while back when you and I were, I think we were at SEMA. It was probably been 2 or 3 years. I had asked about how you got this gig with the stamps
mm-hmm.
for the post office. I thought that was kind of a neat story. Would you share it with us?
I hope it's the same story.
Yeah, me too. Older you get, the better you were, right?
Well, the way it came down, I get asked this a lot. I didn't know it at the time. What happened was I was sitting here at the studio one day working away and the phone rings and I picked it up and it's somebody from the U.S. Postal Service. And, hey, would you be interested in doing a series of stamps? well, what's your answer going to be? You know, I said, yeah, let's do this. You know, I was, you know, wow. The next question is, you know, how did this come about? There was a series of stamps that was started, maybe 10 years ago now. And Art Fitzpatrick, who is the, he was one of the grand masters. I mean, the gentleman, he recently passed here within the last year or two ago.
And for Pontiac, didn't he?
Yes, he did Van Kaufman did the wide track Pontiac ads in the '60s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Art was a young man, a designer, illustrator back in the '30s. And he was the gentleman that penned the Packard Darin. I'm going to say it was the 38. So he has some history behind him. And so I knew of Art Fitzpatrick. And when I was a boy, I go up to my grandma's house, my grandparents' house up there in Tujunga. And while the grandparents were talking to my parents and it was a boring conversation, I would be going through the magazines that my grandmother had on the, you know, laying out on the floor there. And she let me tear out the, AFVK ads for Pontiac because I loved the cars and the way they were rendered. So I was collecting all of his art when I was a boy. And fast forward, I met Art because he was invited to become a member of the Automotive Fine Arts Society, of which I'm a member. This would have been maybe 10 years ago or so. And I met him at the AFAS premier exhibition up there at Pebble Beach at the Concours d'Elegance in, I'm going to say it was 2002, 2003, somewhere in that range. And he appreciated my work and was very complimentary of it. And he and I became good buddies over the years. You know, for me, it was one of those pinch myself moments, you know.
Yeah.
Because of the weight this man had in the world, automotive culture. Well, the post office had a series of stamps, and Art created them, and it was called, Fins of the 50s?
Yeah, I think that, yeah, okay. That sounds right.
Yeah, the post office came up with a series called America in Motion or something. And so the first set of stamps were the Fins of the 50s, I'm going to say. And then there was a second series that Art worked on, and it was, I'm drawing a blank here, but I'm going to say it was Fabulous... Fabulous 50s or Fabulous, it was something like that. But there's a second set of stamps that Art did. Well, the third set of stamps was coming up, and the post office got a hold of Art and said, hey, you want to do these? And by now, Art was feeling his years, and he said he didn't have it in him to do another set of stamps. So the post office said, well, you know, is there anybody you can recommend? And so Art gave him a list, and this is all my understanding. It can probably be corrected somewhere along the line, but he gave him a list, and I guess I was on the list. And the way the post office works, to my understanding, is that they, at that time, they had 15 or 20 art directors working in the stamp business. And these art directors, if you looked at them, these were, you know, some pretty highfalutin folks. A lot of them worked for ad agencies. You know, I did a little bit of research, and I was really impressed with who the art directors were. And, of course, I've been following the postage stamp series since, you know, gosh, when I was a kid. And some of the illustrators that they had working for them over the years were just outstanding. Well, as it went down, apparently they also did a quick search on who was doing what in automotive art, and they came down, and I guess I was the first choice. And so they called me up, and that's how I kind of landed it. I said, yeah, I'd do it. I met my art director, and he and I got together and went out and gathered reference, and off I was going. That's how it came down. But yeah, that's how it worked. It wasn't, you know, there was no lottery. I didn't have to submit a portfolio.
If I recall, that list of artists was quite distinguished. So, you know, and obviously they made a great choice.
Well, it was at Art Fitzpatrick's recommendation. And so I was up there. It must have been a short list. I I recall hearing the names. I can't recall, you know, it's been 8 years or so since I was first contacted. So it's a little fuzzy in my brain, and I don't want to be incorrect in my reflections here.
I'm going through pretty cool when one of your heroes recommends you for the job. That's a pretty cool deal.
Yeah.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that Robert Mapplethorpe was not one of the artists.
Probably not.
Okay. I just thought, never mind. His bullwhip series always sticks in my head. So go ahead. Sorry. For our listeners, if you Google that, don't do it at work. Sorry to interrupt.
Jeez.
But that project was really, it was incredible. It was fun. It went back to my commercial days. I mean, it was a commercial project. However, I had to submit some comps, some sketches, and it was really neat. Was that, I guess, because they, Carl, who was my art director, knew what my work was. They saw my sketches, and I went pretty much direct to panel, to canvas with the paint. And there were no, there were very few corrections or, you know, adjustments to my paintings. I remember one of them was the back of the charger. When I painted it, there was no license plate. And of all the cars, it was the one license plate, because you were looking at the rear of the car, and it was right there, dead center. And my question to them, when they said, there's no license plate. And I remember I answered them. I said, well, there wouldn't be one if you just stole it off the lot. And they had their chuckle and going, well, no, really, seriously, Tom. And I said, well, my next question is, which plate would you like? There's 50 of them.
Sure.
And so they said, well, make it your choice. So California, you know.
Okay, of course.
Black and yellow. And
of course, that wasn't that a Daytona? Yeah, it still had to be a California plate, right?
Yeah, yep. and it worked out good. And I had to Greek everything. You don't want a license plate that you can make out and, you know, turns belong to an old truck somewhere. But yeah, everything had to be Greeked. And was there another situation? Oh, there was the reference car for the Hemi Cuda didn't have the rocker plate on it. It had all the gills, the louvers on the rocker. Panel down on below the door, and that had to be adjusted too. But I think it was pretty much. Oh, the other thing that came up was the Chevelle. If you look at the Chevelle stamp, a woman is driving it, female, and that was they wanted one of the cars had to be a convertible, mm-hmm. And so we all agreed that the Chevelle would be the convertible. And the other thing was, I said, when the car is a convertible, I said, you've just entered another situation here that has to be addressed. I said, you're going to be able to see the driver. And my next question is, male, female, and you know, the race of the driver.
Mm-hmm.
And that opens up a can of worms. Like, just, you know,
mm-hmm. And
if you look, the driver is placed behind the A pillar. So you, that
nicely done.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you had asked me, if you'd have been like, okay, I need a race, gender, et cetera, I'd have just gone, yes. That's usually the answer I get on any brief. What color should it be? Yes.
Exactly. It becomes one of those questions that cannot be answered. And you know, so you try to strike that happy medium. And I did what I would do as an illustrator, and it comes in your training, is you're approached with those problems all the time, and you have to solve them.
How come you got a clown driving the car?
So did you paint in all the door dings and everything, and all the
Danny Faye Baker tribute stamp? That'd be awesome.
Purse sliding across the hood.
Oh, garbage flying around inside. This would be great.
Oh, it is a convertible.
Yeah, it was a fun project. You know,
it was all
yeah.
curbed. Oh, I'm sorry,
but no, it was a good project, and incredibly honored to have done it. And the way the whole thing came down, just, you know, again, another one of those pinch me moments.
Well, yeah, it's great to have that in your, you know, bigger portfolio. And
now I got a question. How big did they have you paint those, or did you paint them to scale?
Painted every one of them on the stamp.
On a needle, they blew them up for the stamps.
This is where, you know, for me, working commercially for all those years, it was a no-brainer. I'm working. What's my final product going to be? It's going to be a half an inch wide by, you know, whatever it is. So it's very small. So
right.
I said, okay, I held my hands up. I said, a 10 inch by 18 inch painting is the same height to width aspect ratio as that postage stamp. And that's the size, you know, after you've done them for so long, you know, you can hold your arms 3 feet out by 4 feet high. That's what you need. No, this one here is 10 by 18. That'll give me, with the way that I work, when you drop it down, everything tightens up.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that I can do a painting that would tighten up so much that painting any larger, I'd be putting in details that would not be readable at that reduced size. So you just know what works for how you work and scale. And that's, you know, that's the size of the paintings. They were 10 by 18. They were painted on a Masonite panel. And the way that the post office explained it to me in easy terms so I could understand it, no artist signs the face of the painting. So I signed the back of the panels. And the reason for that is because they said it was pretty darn close. It's not the same thing, but it's pretty darn close to American currency. And the artist that designs the dollar bill doesn't sign his name to it, you know.
Okay. So, I would have
Andrew Jackson
hidden that in there, or at least some.
I always hide my name in stuff that I'm not supposed to sign.
Well, Del, yeah. Del, you know how what I like to hide in all of my work. That just wouldn't work on a postage stamp. So,
I got another question, Tom. Where did the originals end up at?
They are now in the National Postal Museum at the Smithsonian Institute.
Outstanding.
Oh, fantastic. Wow. Okay.
I'm planning a trip there with my son, cool. So this is going to be right there. You gave me the first thing to beeline for.
That's you cool. know, again, another pinch-me situation for me. It's a it's pretty small company in that you know, when I consider that those paintings are you know, I don't know where they're at, probably in a drawer somewhere, but you know, they're the other artists that are in there that have done the stamps too. It's like, wow, that's, you know, it's just an incredible honor. It just keeps, mm-hmm. it just keeps going on and on. But, no, it's just, you know, that's where they're at right now.
Okay. That's cool. So with your paintings, is that how you work on Masonite usually?
It's like the painting tells me what it's going to be on.
Okay.
You understand that? I do paint on canvas a lot. I don't normally paint on a 24 by 36 or a 20 by 30 or a 24 by 24. The painting, to me, I've gotten to a point now where my paintings, the aspect ratio is mandated by the image.
Okay.
And like I said, the substrate that I'm working on is also, you know, when I paint on Masonite, the paint slides off my brush differently than it does on my canvas.
Yeah.
And that has a direct link to the image that I'm anticipating at the far end of this, you know, so, sometimes I want a slipperier feel on the brush and I'll work on the Masonite. Or sometimes I'll work on the canvas because I want a certain quality to the paint application. You know, the canvas drags the paint off the brush differently, and that's what I'm looking for, so I'll paint on canvas.
And a bit more texture.
A little bit of texture.
However you want
to. There's also the feel. The Masonite or the door skin that I work on, it's harder, and the paintbrush has a different feel when you poke that canvas. It's harder on the brush, and when you poke on a canvas, the way I stretch my canvases, I like them like drum tight. There's a slight shock absorption to it. You know, it gives a little bit. So that has a different feel too. And in some places where my brush work becomes more of a staccato, you know, machine gun kind of application, that bounce in the canvas kind of, it helps me. It works better for me.
Okay.
It's a feel thing.
Well, not to give away any secrets whatsoever. I mean, if you're pulling a Salvador Dali and making your own, you know, mediums by like squeezing a weasel into a carton of orange juice or something like that. Do you use any particular medium with your work, or do you have like, is there like a set Tom Fritz sort of a method for that as far as using mediums or anything like that, additives?
No, that I worked commercially for too long, and you know, about working commercially, you got to get the job done. You got to get it out. You know, it's got to be finished, dried, and out the door. And that's carried over into my work. I could grind my own pigments, but dang it, you know, the art supply stores have so much of it and it's ready to go. I'll just put something there. The same thing. There are so many different kinds of mediums, and they all have their special blends. And I've read about them, and I used to mix them at the start, and it's just an additional process that to me doesn't, it actually gets in the way and hinders the spirit of my work that, you know, I want to get it done. I want to enjoy the act, and sitting there mixing and measuring and, you know, I don't do that. So Liquin has even changed now. I go for the old original Liquin, medium. Dries pretty quick. Sometimes I'll just use the mineral spirits with my oil paints, depending on how thick you want it. Your paint, the mineral spirits. If you're putting it on a white house primer, it sucks up pretty darn quick, and it dries in a couple hours. It's ready to go.
Very nice.
So there's, you know, it's how you want to work, how you want to get it down. Sometimes I'll use a Sikkative dryer or a Japan dryer if I'm looking for something to dry quicker. But then you have other issues, cracking and stuff that happens if you put too much of that in. You have to kind of know all that. Here I am looking at your picture on the Skype deal, trying to maintain my sanity.
The meeting that Dell has chosen is not hair drill.
But yeah, Copal medium is another one that sometimes, you know, I'll take the cap off of the copal medium and I'll dip a palette knife into it and put two or three drops of it into my white. You know, I squeeze out a big blob of white on the palette. And I'll just chop it in there, and that makes the white, which goes into almost every color anyways. You know, it helps dry the paint faster too. I can get my paints to kick in about 6 hours if I really wanted to.
Wow.
So, yeah, and, you know, so it's all kind of like when you've painted for miles and miles and miles, you kind of know what you're looking for and how to anticipate it. And you look at the clock on the wall and you figure, hey, you know, if I'm going to get some shut eye here, I can put my licks in the next 3 hours. And when I wake up, the painting will be ready to work on, you know. So it's kind of intuitive. You know, you kind of know what you're doing. And it's hard to explain. I understand it as a student because I was there one time too, or as a person new to it. You're trying to absorb all of the mediums and the, you know, what do you clean your brushes with? Terpenite or paint thinner you know, all these secrets and time tested through the centuries, you know. How, you know, do I wash my brushes? No. And the reason I don't wash brushes is because I scrub them down too fast. I paint, you know, and brushes to me are just part of the process. I don't fall in love with them, you know. Once a brush is gone, I chuck it and grab a new one.
Just a tool.
It's a tool. It's, you know, my thumb is a tool too, and so is a little wad of paper towel. It, you know, it, whatever works at the time, you know.
Right.
You know, it's all good.
Well, hopefully you don't wear your thumb out and chuck it.
Well, yeah.
Like Brian does.
Usually it winds up somewhere else where it shouldn't be, and I get paint somewhere, you know.
Which Brian does as well.
Yeah, so Brian, I go all, it's all natural when I'm working, so there's paint everywhere. Yeah, I always wondered, like I had had so many instructors when I went to school they all had their secret matters. It was like, you have to mix this particular oil with this. It's the only way to make this paint layout. And I always wondered, I had one who was very big on peanut oil. And to this day, I wonder if any of his paintings have caused like an allergic reaction somewhere. You know, think about this crap all the time.
I just, you know, I remember getting these cans of oils and you know, mediums and I've used I have to admit it, but I've used kerosene sometimes in my paintings because to clean my brushes, because it's got a different, you know, when the brush is cleaned in kerosene, and before you dip into the paint again, it's a little bit oilier and it's got a different feel to it.
Oh, I mean, it does. I've done that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean. And if you tell people, some people, you know, oh, I just go down to the hardware store and get kerosene. They're looking at you like, what? You're buying your stuff and your paintings from a hardware store? Well, yeah.
It's all about that. It's experimentation. I mean, nobody understands. You've got to be one part, you know, color theorist, another part, you know, fine artist, part chemist. And then, you know, when you figure out all these things are having a reaction on you, you become kind of a freelance doctor for yourself. You know, you're a physician in your own home, diagnosing what caused that nasty growth on your thumb.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the early days, especially back in school, we had to clean our brushes with turpentine. And I love the smell of turpentine. God, you know, I love the smell of oil paints. I love, you know, I just... Mm-hmm. Love the smell. That's why I work in oils probably most. But acrylics always smelled like dirty socks to me or something. Just a bunch of, you know. But And I always remember that after some studio sessions, especially if you're with other artists and stuff, you go back home and your throat is locking up on you because of that turpentine stuff.
Yeah.
I just got away from it, and I found out that and other artists will laugh at me and hex me, you know. But just regular paint thinner, you know, it does what I want it to do. It always has. You know, that's why I clean my brushes with mostly now. It's a very, very simple process. My painting, I made it simple back in the days when I was cranking out commercial stuff because it had to be done. It had to be dry. It had, you know, and plus there was the old school of thought that if you're working commercially, as long as the paint stayed on the canvas until it was photographed,
yeah,
and the check cleared.
Well,
next
one other weird question then, kind of on that. Do you ever get requested? Say you're doing a commission piece. Do you ever have it requested to do it in a particular medium? I mean, have you ever had someone come to you and say, "I want this painted completely in tempera paint with sidewalk chalk and maybe day glow window markers"?
You sound like my old boss. No, it's the oils. There's oil paints still for people, for art purchasers, especially who I'm dealing with. The oil paints are the what they're looking for. There's a the colors have much more impact.
Definitely. And there seems to be that stigma too, where if you were to compare, to me, just always felt that way. If you saw an oil painting next to an acrylic, the oil painting seems to have much more of some kind of an intrinsic quality about it that makes it, I don't want to knock anyone on this. Not what I'm trying to say. It just seems that would be, worth more and have more longevity to it.
Yeah. I mean, it's the master's painted in oil, and so you're going to make it as close as you can to something that the master's, something with that value to it. Use the best materials available. Acrylics, I as a commercial artist, I did everything. I everything from charcoal to dry pastel to acrylics, Prismacolor, ink, everything, markers, airbrush. But the acrylics to me, have you ever seen an acrylic that's maybe more than 10 years old, 15 years old? The paint is kind of sticky, and there's a, the atmosphere has settled on the paint, and there's a quality to it that it needs to be cleaned or something. To my eye, it just looks like, the rafters on my house,
just dulls, and it looks like your neighbor's car that was painted in the 70s with lacquer paint and never waxed. It just has that sort of milky.
So
if we do have any rafter cleaners listening in Southern California, Tom Fritz is looking for a good referral.
Now I have to now all my. My stocks in acrylic now are worthless.
I'm sorry.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Talking about acrylics, Liquitex is like one of the top manufacturers of it. Did you know that, or do you remember when Liquitex made oil paints?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember? They were incredible. They were gorgeous. I mean, I still have tubes of Liquitex oil paints. And what was it back in the late 80s, early 90s, maybe, they stopped. And they just went solely to acrylics. And I always wondered why.
I have no idea. I still have a few tubes too, I think.
And remember all of the Liquitex products, I haven't bought a tube of acrylics in a long time. But remember they were all, I want to say they all had their their standards for the Munsell color chart, you know, where they sat on the Munsell color chart, mm-hmm. and the value system that they occupied, and all that stuff was on the tube, and that was handy. You know, there's a whole Liquitex really did pretty well with marketing that that whole system of mixing the colors per hue, per value, and what you could reasonably expect what your mix was going to make. It was the neatest system. I loved it, and I don't know if they're still doing that now, but yeah.
Well, listen up, Liquitex. We want your oils.
Yeah, really.
Bring them back. Some of the old brush manufacturers that have left and I guess come back now. Remember the Series 7s, Winsor Newtons?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They disappeared, and I guess recently, just because of everybody screaming, they came back now. I think I'm pretty sure they came back. Maybe you guys can correct me on that.
No, actually, I believe I did hear that.
Yeah. I mean, the red sable, the animal that made the fur for those brushes was extinct it was pretty close to extinction or something like that. So they had to stop making them. But the Klinsky sable, or what do they call it?
Cute. It sounds delicious.
Yeah.
It was. No, oh, sorry.
No. I had to start pulling my mustache hairs out to make my brushes.
I was going to ask you. That was my next question. I was going to ask you because
they are making
my earlier Dolly references.
When he says that was a booger of a painting.
I noticed you don't have any facial hair. How are you? How are you so good without having that? You know, the mustache. That's what I thought the secret was. So.
Well, this is what it looked like before puberty.
Oh, there you go. Another reason for someone to visit your site.
Yeah.
You can go back in time and visit Tom pre-puberty.
That could be a whole blog post.
Yeah. That's going to be the name of this.
Tom Fritz before puberty?
Tom? Pre-puberty Tom.
Right.
Discusses making... never mind. Paintbrushes from extinct animals. Perfect. That's a long blog post title, but we'll figure it out.
Well, they are making that brush again, so.
Cool.
Are they?
Yeah.
Is it synthetic, or are they like Jurassic Parking the whole thing, and one day we're going to be overrun by these sables?
That's a very good question. I don't know.
They're not synthetic. It's I think the animal is called a Klinsky sable, or it's a red sable. It's like a little squirrel kind of animal, a rodent maybe, but it has this gorgeous orange-red fur on its tail or something, and they make these brushes out of them, and Winsor Newton makes this number 7 sable, and it's a very, very fine brush with it holds watercolor ink, you know, really well, and the thing about it is it has this very responsive, flexible tip that can take you from a hairline to a 3/16 inch thickness, you know, very smoothly and cleanly. It's you know, it has a really wonderful response. You know, I purchased a whole bunch of them years ago and still have quite a few left, but I when I heard that they were going out, I just shook my head. A lot of the good old art supplies are disappearing. The Blackwing pencils. It's a pencil that has a certain carbon, I guess, graphite, that makes this wonderful black, and it's incredibly smooth to use. And it's most notable for its shape. It's a regular pencil, but when you get to the eraser tip on it, it kind of flattens out and had a kind of a flat pink eraser on it. There's a gentleman out there, another artist, Ed Tilrock, he works in graphite a lot, does beautiful drawings, and he just, you know, he's old school, he's a few years older than me, and he remembers that the pencils were different back then, and he and I we talk about the pencils that are missing, the old 314 drafting pencils. I don't think they make those anymore. There were some wonderful go-to pencils that you just knew them for the way they handled. And when you've done it enough, you know, there's a hand to using those art supplies. And sadly now they're disappearing. You pick up a pencil, it's made at the, you know, a Ticonderoga, I don't think is made in the United States anymore. You pick it up and it's gravelly and rough. And
well, the wood is plastic also.
Oh yeah.
You know,
they're, you know, it has just changed. Mm-hmm. And you know, the old standards are gone. And, but what does that mean as an artist is we have to evolve and kind of, I guess, accept that. And you work within the realm of what you have. And so your work has to, you gotta swap up. Mm-hmm. There's brushes I used to use 30 years ago that are no longer made. And, there are pens that are no longer made, and I had to buy the last of the, what are they called? Calligraphic pens by Sanford.
Okay.
They're now made by Sharpie, and Sharpie doesn't make them in certain colors anymore. Hmm. And some of those colors were something that I use. So, you know.
You know, talking about Ed Tilrock, a couple of years ago, I was talking to him, and he said that he will go to yard sales and estate sales and stuff just to try to find old pencils.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You cannot get a quality pencil for illustration anymore. And yes. He says, you know, he'll buy, you know, 20 or 30 of them wrapped together with a rubber band. And, you know, the people are thinking, oh, who's going to buy these? Yeah, Ed will.
Yep. I know he.
Okay, you just opened up a whole market for that.
Yeah, he has some of his collectors, some of his Facebook followers, you know, his fans.
Mm-hmm.
They're digging through their old junk and sending him their pencils. I mean, mm-hmm. he's got a good thing. He's got a good thing going, and yeah, but he, you know, and in doing his pencil work. You know, you can see the way that he handles it and applies the graphite. The softness of the pencil makes a big difference for him, and they just don't make them the way they used to.
Yeah, for sure.
It's kind of sad, especially when you see Ed, who's put the miles down on those things, and you know, it hurts actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not just your world, Tom, and my world. I'm a pinstriping lettering guy. That's what I've done forever and ever. And the brushes have gone bye-bye. My favorite pinstriping brush no longer exists. My favorite lettering brush no longer exists. So I had to change over. And the paint, they took the, you know, one shot had a lot of lead in it. That's what made it last and made it actually do what it did in it. And they took that out back in the late 80s and... I mean, I don't know who was licking it, so it's not like it really mattered, but...
sorry. You know, yeah. Well, they took it out of their own accord, I'm told, and to stop any future, you know, problems. But then the problems with the paint not drying and the paint not covering started up, so...
Yeah, so... It all goes all the way, and then in California, you know, now you have all this compliance stuff. So, you know, thinners and everything, nothing is. It's like using mineral spirits. It's, you can't even use California mineral spirits anymore because it's just terrible stuff. So we're all in the same boat you are. It's just
we have a problem out here in Arizona. They no longer make the old $50 bills. That I used to like a lot. I'd like it if any of our listeners could send me
ones that the old $50 bill. There you go.
Thought it was worth a shot.
Nice.
I do have a business proposition, though, speaking of all this stuff. What if I knew someone who perhaps their great-grandmother used to cut Gustav Klimt's hair, and what if we started offering, like, Klimt brushes? Just saying, somebody might have kept a baggie full of.
It's kind of like your used food idea. Yeah, this is perfect. There, this is.
I'm 3 for 3 tonight. But you can continue this. We're all going to be rich by the end of the night. clipped sable brush is done.
Well, hopefully you've had fun on here, Tom. Have you had fun on here?
Absolutely, guys. I've had this stupid smile plastered on my face since it started.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I can't say thank you enough.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's more than just a pleasure to have you here. This is spectacular for us.
I enjoyed your questions. They weren't of the standard, you know, what's your favorite color? You know, it's
like, what's your favorite color?
Usually tan line is one of my favorites, or, goose turd green. Oh, I like plaid.
Plaid is a great one. Especially if you can do the ultraviolet plaid is a nice one.
It feels really nice off
plaid. That was good.
Thanks again for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes and feel free to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast if you would. Also, be sure to keep in touch with us on our website at www.round6pod.com.